Case for this morning, United States against Young. Yes, Mr. Poe.
May it please the court, a legal opinion of guilt by a criminal defendant's former lawyer, which is what the statements in this case amounted to, is categorically different from the kinds of statements that were at issue in this court's decisions in Harris, Sanders, and Brandon. Harris simply was a case in which a lawyer was acting as an investigator and factual statements concerning his conduct came into evidence just as they would if an investigator was doing the same thing. In Sanders, a former lawyer was interviewing two of the co-conspirators in prison. The fact of that interview is what was introduced into evidence. In Brandon, a lawyer's letter in response to a grand jury subpoena denying the existence of documents was admitted in order to deny the existence of the defendant's good faith. These sorts of statements in this case fall well on the other side of the line under the policy standards that this court enunciated in both Harris and Sanders, and that the court has followed in Brandon as well.
Well, now, Mr. Poe, it seems to me that the statements about what Mr. Fox said are kind of mixed statements. They contain in them some facts. The money's all gone. The money and the collateral's all gone. They do contain words like improper and illegal. But that said, there are a number of statements. Does he pronounce it Young or Jung? How does
Young,
he,
Your Honor.
Young. That Mr. Young himself made that are pretty powerful statements about his knowledge of the wrongfulness of his conduct. And so I don't see why, even if we agreed with you that given Fox's capacity as the lawyer, this perhaps needed a more careful look, why does it matter here?
Well, I think the statements that Your Honor may be referring to attributed to Mr. Young, namely an affidavit that he signed.
He signed in the bankruptcy proceeding, right?
Correct, Your Honor. Yeah. That is absolutely right. I think those statements go to the issue of whether the error was harmless, which is the government's alternative argument here.
Right, and I'm kind of asking you about that, too, because I'm saying even if we gave you the benefit of the doubt and thought that under our law one shouldn't so readily assume that the lawyer is just a regular old agent like any other agent might be, I don't see in this record very much attention to that particular special relationship with the lawyer, but why isn't it harmless error?
Well, it's not harmless error because once a profoundly damaging statement like this comes in, and Your Honor, it's more than, I believe, sort of mixed aspects. It is illegal and improper trading. It's a characterization of a statement that Mr. Young is said to have made as a confession. It is a statement that Mr. Young took assets unbeknownst to the investors. These go to the heart of the case.
That third one, though, is just a statement of fact. There's nothing legal opinion about I took assets unbeknownst to the investors.
Well, I believe a taking, the very use of that term conveys the impropriety that makes it illegal.
But wait a minute. I mean, we all talk about somebody taking something every day. I'm trying to give you the benefit of the doubt on some of these, that maybe they're legal opinions, but that third one.
Well, Your Honor, I certainly would focus, putting everything else to one side, improper and illegal and confession are powerful words. And Your Honor asks, what's the effect of that? Well, what it does is it creates a peculiar type of lens through which the jury is going to assess every aspect of the case. And that lens is a government lens. At that point, once the jury hears that a defendant's own former lawyer has offered opinions like this, the jury is going to look at bias issues, credibility issues of every government witness through the government lens. The jury is going to view issues like Mr. Young's affidavit through the government lens. There was a fully coherent defense theory of this case that Mr. Young never had a chance to have the jury consider in its proper light because the government's lens was what was making.
He made his own confession, though, didn't he?
Well, but Your Honor, this was the affidavit in which, for example, paragraph 17 of that affidavit says, "I wrongfully permitted the clearing firm to handle the assets a certain way." Well, that contradicts CBOE rules that contradicts what the clearing firm's policies were. So the fact that he makes an affidavit that has a statement in it that is not true itself is consistent with the defense theory of the case, which is he was just going along with whatever this lawyer was having him do. He signed a stipulation that said the assets are not dischargeable. It was a non-dischargeability stipulation. He basically confessed fraud, according to the government, in that affidavit. But the evidence is clear in this case that the statutory section, the non-dischargeability section in fraud in the bankruptcy code, was never explained to Mr. Young. The lawyer wanted to get this deal done. He had a plan. There is no question that he had a plan that was, rightly or wrongly, to get Mr. Young to open his mouth and cooperate with everybody under the sun. That doesn't mean that Mr. Young is guilty of a crime. What it shows is that he, perhaps, was led by the nose by a lawyer who did everything backwards. Now,
did you know, I mean, there's other evidence, too. There's this guy, Lehman, who testifies that Mr. Young tearfully tells us he's very disappointed in himself. He's broken our trust. He'd been able to convince them to let him trade SIF's account for his own benefit. There are, of course, the stipulations in the bankruptcy court. Mr. Young does not seem like such a babe in the woods to me, maybe he was a very bad trader. I don't know. But
well, according to Mr. Lehman, he was a very good trader in the strategic income fund sub-account. That was the hedge fund at issue here. Mr. Lehman, this is the issue in the case. This goes to the bias and the credibility issues. There is, once the government gets in the statement, and I would ask the court to consider why, if the evidence is so powerful, why does the government fight tooth and nail to get this man's statements into evidence? They fought tooth and nail to get this man's statements into evidence. And I asked the court to consider.
I'm not sure what tooth and nail fighting involves at a court level, but well, they proffered the evidence and suggested that it ought to be admitted.
True, Your Honor.
And defense lawyer objected to a tooth and nail, using your same definition. The question is, should it have gone in, not whether anybody fought tooth or nail.
What I'm getting at, Your Honor, pardon the passion, you know, but the
I understand passion. I'm just yeah. calming it down.
But Your Honor, what I'm getting at is, for example, on cross-examination, after the defense lawyer, having objected, had to deal with this some way, and he tried, the government then went back on cross-examination to try to get the witness, the government's witness, who was the lawyer that Mr. Young's former lawyer had spoken with, tried to get him to say that these were the exact words that Mr. Young's former lawyer had used, improper and illegal trading, the degree of emphasis is all I'm getting at, Your Honor. But
powerful terms.
But they had to prove that point, I suppose, somehow, and maybe you're saying they should have just left it with Lehman reporting that Mr. Young himself was disappointed in himself and that he'd broken trust and all the rest.
I mean, those are Mr. Young's admissions. Under the rules of evidence, those come in. But Mr. Lehman is the hedge fund promoter. He has everything to lose by saying anything other than what he said. The most powerful motive to lie Mr. Lehman had, and his Mr. Young's lawyer, trial lawyer, argued this below extensively. Mr. Lehman, all of these investors, they had interest in a pending lawsuit.
Save your time.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Kohler. Are you the person who was fighting tooth and nail, Mr. Kohler?
Good morning, Your Honor. I don't know that I was fighting tooth and nail, but yes, I was the attorney on the case, Your Honor, the trial attorney in this.
Why is it necessary to put in the attorney's testimony in this case? That's the question he raised, but with less passion, tell me why.
Yes, Your Honor.
He had an overwhelming case. He got a confession.
In addition to substantial other evidence, Your Honor, in the form of documents and multiple other witnesses that laid the pattern in this particular case of the guilt. But in answer to your question, the testimony in this particular instance came earlier on in the trial.
You mean you didn't realize you had all this other good stuff, and so you leap forward with the attorney's discussion?
Obviously, Your Honor, we understood what we had, and we hoped that it would all be admitted into trial. But
did it occur to you that the question of some other the defendant's lawyer testifying might create a problem for you?
Under the circumstances of this particular case, Your Honor, no. And the circumstances being
being what?
This was a situation that the defendant was faced with at the time that there was substantial evidence of a $21 million fraud for which he was responsible, as the court may understand.
I'm talking about your behavior in offering in evidence the testimony of a lawyer who represented a defendant. And tell me why you think that's justified.
Because it was part of the defendant's overall strategy at the beginning to...
You knew the defendant's strategy?
It was part of the evidence at trial, that there was testimony at trial.
I know, but I say you went first. Your turn is at bat first. You have to put the evidence in. So you don't know what it... Other than pleading not guilty, he doesn't have to tell you what his strategy is.
Well, no, but what I mean, Your Honor, by the strategy is not at the trial itself, but at when this first came to light in September of 1998, the first thing that happened was that James Fox called Isaf and Lehman and had that conversation with them. But very quickly after that, Judge, based on that conversation, Lehman and Isaf came to Chicago and they met with Fox. And at that time, James Fox gave them a letter, which Mr. Lehman said, testified at trial, was the equivalent of a confession. Within a day or so, then the defendant and Mr. Fox met with Isaf and Lehman and others. At the end of that meeting, Isaf and Lehman told him, either you turn yourself into the criminal authorities or we will. And so the defendant continued then, to take a cooperative mode towards victims, regulators, and criminal authorities.
I'm having a good time with you following along, but I still want to know, why do you have to have the lawyer come in and testify to this?
It basically what it did,
supposing the lawyer, supposing the lawyer walked into your office and said, I represent a guilty client, could you get and call him on the stand and put that into evidence?
If a lawyer walked into my office, no, Judge, I wouldn't do that based on
that. Well, this is a practical equivalent of that.
First of all, he wasn't speaking with a prosecutor.
No, he was speaking to the public yard, but the prosecutor now has him speak to the jury.
He was speaking to people.
Supposing the same lawyer that I've talked about, instead of coming into your office, stands on the corner of Dearborn and Jackson and says, I represent a guilty client. Would you be able to call him, put him on the stand and say, would you say what you said down there?
I don't know what the statement I represent a guilty client means, just like in this particular instance.
Suppose he said my client stole money and I represent him.
Obviously.
As far as I'm concerned, you better get at the idea that this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, because I cannot understand why a prosecutor wants to call a defendant's lawyer and ask him about what the lawyer said about his client's conduct. It just strikes me as being off the wall.
Well, Judge, if you're asking me in hindsight, would I think differently about doing it? The answer is yes. But that's after hindsight, after a long trial, after substantial evidence has come in. But at the same time, Your Honor, I believe that the statements of Mr. Fox are all admissible under the rule and do not violate.
They came in, just to make sure I'm clear about what happened. I thought it was not so much that Mr. Fox was on the stand, but that there was testimony that came in under Rule 801 about what Mr. Fox had said, and it was regarded as a statement of the agent of a party. Is that?
Yes, Your Honor. We did not call Mr. Fox. The statement came.
There's other people saying, yeah, Fox said X to me, and that was, of course, hearsay unless you got it in as a party statement.
Was it the position of the government that the lawyer was a participant in the fraud?
No, it was not our position.
So it was
that
not
Mr.
made
Fox
a
statement.
It wasn't a statement made by an agent in furtherance of the conspiracy about the conspiracy.
No, it had nothing to do with the conspiracy. No. It was just an agent statement.
So the attorney is an agent. In my hypothetical, somebody walks in and says, defendant's attorney just told me he's representing a guilty guy. You couldn't put that in.
Well, Your Honor, it would be something that obviously you would have to look at, but it wouldn't be something that I've done in my career to date, Judge. No, I haven't done that. But that's not the circumstances in this particular case. In this particular case, it was all part of if you look at it, what the defendant's response was to being caught. Essentially, he became cooperative. And so,
how about if you would focus, though, on, because, of course, your opponent's position is once all of these statements that Fox made come in indirectly, as they did, it just taints the whole trial, and you can't find error that's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
I would direct the court to Government Exhibits 66 and 67, Your Honor, in a nutshell, and they're attached to our brief. There is substantial and overwhelming evidence, separate and apart from any statements of either the defendant or the defendant's lawyer, about what actually happened here, that from January 1995 straight through to September of 1998, when the fraud was discovered, the defendant used the money that he collected from the various victims, almost $21 million, for his own personal trading, to take cash withdrawals, and also to keep his business afloat. So any time after January of 1995, if he didn't continue to bring in new investor funds, which he did all the way through until August of 1998, he would have been out of business. He would have no longer been able to trade. This is all in documents. It has nothing to do with Mr. Fox or, for that matter, the defendant's admissions. This is all set out in great detail. The other those two.
The scienter element, which I think Mr. Poe has raised. Yes, well, you can see he was doing all of it, but do we know that he knew it was the wrong thing to do?
Absolutely, Judge, because what you'll see is that there's testimony that every day as a trader and running this broker-dealer, he got what the position was, where they stood financially. And as you can see from the charts, and I believe it's 66 or 67, I should say, that as time goes by, more and more money comes in from the investors, and down here at the bottom is where the financial condition of the company is. So, for instance, very quickly, in May of 1998, at the end of that month, there are $22 million some odd dollars invested by these victims. The entire net worth of all of the defendants' accounts are slightly over $3 million. So that leaves a $19 million deficit. The defendant is still bringing new investors in. For instance, Jordan Roane invested $2 million at about this time. His son-in-law went and talked to Mr. Young. Mr. Young told him that they were doing very, very well in the fund. Well, as soon as the $2 million went in, it was diluted, and he lost the entire thing within months. Graph number 66 shows you that the defendant's trading, starting with September of 1994, was starting at a losing position and continued straight down losing all the way through the end of this in September of 1998. One other quick example of what I believe shows the intent. If you look at the testimony of Jack Hunt, one of his employees, and one of his traders, Jeff Giannone, both of them testified about the fraudulent reallocation of trades. Young was taking trades from his personal accounts and other places and moving the winners into accounts for the victims. So it would make the victims look like they were making money. They weren't. The other thing I would put forth, Judge, I see my time is almost up. If you take a look at the testimony about the quarterly reports that all of the victims received throughout this entire scheme, none of those quarterly reports ever showed anything other than people were profiting. Everybody was profiting. Their investments were not
jeopardized. This just underlines Judge Bauer's question, doesn't it? If you got all this evidence, what do you need with the lawyer's comments?
Well, from my standpoint, once again, Your Honor, it was early on in the trial when that came in. It was kind of to put things in context. This was one conversation. This was one sentence from one conversation. We went through the entire movement, you know, to the U.S. Attorney's Office, to the FBI, to the SEC. That was the choice that the defendant made, to be cooperative. At some point in time, he chose to go to trial. That's his right. But I would simply say that from the government standpoint, we believe that the statements of James Fox were properly admitted by Judge Lefkoe, and we would ask the court to affirm both the conviction and the sentence in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Poe.
The government points to Government Exhibits 66 and 67, which indeed show mounting losses. What the accountant for the fund itself knew all about these losses. And that is one of the reasons why Mr. Young could reasonably have believed that people were on notice of the risks. Now, options trading, as the court probably knows far better than I, is an extremely risky business. And
I have the foggiest idea. I'm willing to take your word for it.
I will rely on what counsel for the for Mr. Young said at the sentencing, and that options traders are a particular breed who think that they can always get back into the black. That is why a man over the course of time can think that he is going to do
impulsive
okay.
Impulsive gamblers have exactly the same defense. I always thought I would get ahead, and they take money to take somebody else's money to do the gambling. The compulsive aspect of it falls into insignificance.
Well, understood, Your Honor, but what I'm saying is that there are explanations for why losses could mount, and it's not merely an indication of a criminal state of mind. Pardon me, Your Honor?
I thought I'd win. That's the explanation.
Well, let me get to just a couple of other points. The fraudulent reallocation point that Mr. Kohler has pointed to, I just point the court to pages 1546 to 47 and 45 of the transcript, and 1114 would show. Usually these were done right near the trade time. Mistakes are made all the time on the floor. Every once in a while, Mr. Young would direct a reallocation. There is room for dispute about exactly what that testimony meant. And the same thing goes for the quarterly reports, which are income statements, not balance sheets. And the accountant was the one sending these out. He had done the same thing in a prior investment that these people were all involved in, and it didn't include cross-collateralization risk. So I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow morning.